Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its author's intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special two-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
Hey everyone, it's Aisha. And before we get into this week's episode, we have a very exciting announcement to make. Actually, Verilyn's here with me too.
Yeah, I resisted everything in me not to be like, yeah. I was trying to be good.
Anyway, we have a very exciting announcement for you all. We are doing our very first live show.
Woo!
Yes. So, for the first time ever, Slate will be bringing two live shows, Yours Truly Represent, yes, and Trumpcast, to the Tribeca Film Festival. Our show is scheduled for Monday, April 24th at 6:45 p.m. at the SVA Theater in Manhattan, and Trumpcast will be taping on Tuesday, April 30th at 8:15 p.m. at the same location. We can't quite reveal just yet what we'll have in store for you, but it'll be good, and you should be on the lookout on Facebook and Twitter for announcements.
Yes.
Slate Plus members, you'll receive a discount starting at 25% off for your tickets to these shows and select festival screenings and events. Though the discount code does not apply to general screening matinees, the Beacon Theater, or Radio City Music Hall events, just FYI. For more information and tickets, visit slate.com/live. We'll also, of course, link to it on our show page, and we better see y'all there if you're in New York.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
If man realizes technology is within reach, he achieves it, like it's damn near instinctive. Look at us, for example. We're state of the art. Controlled metabolisms, computer-enhanced brains, cybernetic bodies. Not long ago, this was science fiction. So what if we can't survive without regular high-level maintenance? Who are we to complain? I suppose an occasional tune-up is a small price to pay for all this.
I'm afraid we've both signed our bodies and ghosts away to Section 9.
What's up, y'all? I'm Aisha Harris, and this is Represent. Welcome back. You just heard a scene from the 1995 anime hit Ghost in the Shell, which has now been remade into a live-action flick starring Scarlett Johansson that Paramount, DreamWorks, and all the other involved parties undoubtedly hope will also be a hit. We'll see about that. We'll be talking about the new version and the controversy surrounding Johansson's casting, as well as other recent debates centering around Asian representation on screen in recent Hollywood fare, including Netflix's latest Marvel release, Iron Fist. Now, I was lucky enough to nab MTV News' Ingu Kang and making his return, the lovely Alex Jung from Vulture. But first, we're bringing you a new installment of Recognize with Verilyn Williams,
hey.
My wonderful producer.
How you doing?
Hey, I'm good. So just to remind listeners, Recognize is when we take just a few quick minutes to break down a character or show that we feel really deserves to be talked about and discussed.
Deserves, or maybe even surprisingly, pleasantly surprised.
Yeah, something that's pleasantly surprising. And we can't talk about everything on the show at as much as we'd like and in as much depth as we like. But this is just a little, teaser to get people, interested in some, things that they might be flying under the radar. So for you, your Recognize this week, Verilyn, is...
Big Little Lies.
Okay. So I've heard a little bit about the show. I haven't watched it yet, so you're going to be informing me as well as those who haven't seen
awesome.
It yet.
Oh my gosh, so much pressure.
All right, go. In 5 minutes.
Okay. Oh my God. All right. So Big Little Lies is a book turned into a television show. It stars Reese Witherspoon, Nicole Kidman, and Charlene Woodley. And I know you're thinking, Verilyn, you just named three white women. I hear you.
There's nothing wrong with that.
There's nothing wrong with that, especially since... Okay, so the reason I ended up binging all of the episodes on Sunday is because my book club read the book. And so me and my girlfriend were like, okay, let's go ahead and watch the TV show. And I was so... Nicole Kidman. We need to just go ahead and give her an Emmy for this role.
Wait, can you explain what's happening in the show?
Okay, so it's a show centered around moms. In the book, it's about moms in Australia. And in the TV show, it's about moms in Monterey, California. And all of these women have children in this very elite public school. And it's all of them are very petty. It's like the best kind of
it sounds like Desperate Housewives.
It's like Desperate Housewives meets Love and Hip Hop. Like, it's just like.
So really just Real Housewives of Monterey, California.
There we go.
Okay.
Yes, yes, yes. Exactly. And like I said, the community is very white, right? But every opportunity they had to have a person of color, they did. So, it centers around this mystery, this, murder that you learn very early on. It's, I think in the first episode, there's just, somebody is dead. The detective is black. Both the detectives are black. The principal is a black man. Another thing that happens is that there's an investigation where they're, interviewing people and asking them about the murder. And so, random people that they're talking to from the school and community are people of color. Zoe Kravitz.
Yeah.
plays, oh my God. I mean, first of all, talk about her genes, right? She's just from all the beautifulness.
I know.
That is Lenny Kravitz. And what's her mom from? Denise.
Lisa Bonet.
I'm like,
come
Denise.
On now.
I know.
She'll always be Denise, but still.
She plays Bonnie, who is one of the wives. And in the TV show, she actually gets more of a role than she did in the book. Right. And so, again, this is somebody in the book that was kind of an off character. You get the sense that she's white because all the characters are white, but they made the choice to make her a woman of color because why the fuck not?
Amen. See how easy it is?
It's so easy. It's so easy. But, even though all that representation is great, I really do want to give a shout out to Nicole Kidman's performance. I don't think it's a spoiler to say that she plays a domestic violence victim. And anyone that has ever come in contact with someone that's been abused or has been abused themselves, or there's something about the way, there's a scene where she's talking to a therapist and just the way she plays that out, I was like, I felt it. Like, it stayed with me. Mm. It's still with me. It's very powerful. Highly recommend it. And not only for her character, but also to see some people of color.
Yeah.
In a very white plot.
So, despite my hesitations to watch it, which were mainly that I've heard mixed things about it, and also the fact that it just sounded like Desperate Housewives on HBO, I should watch it.
Well, we already established that me and you have very different tastes.
We do.
In television.
We do, but I do love all, I love Reese Witherspoon. I love Zoe Kravitz, and I enjoy Nicole Kidman.
Yeah. And Reese Witherspoon's character, Madeline, is very consistent. She's my favorite character, actually, because she's super consistent. She's bitchy, she's petty, and I love it.
All right. So on this day, we recognize Big Little Lies as a show.
Surprise!
As a show that is doing surprisingly well at representing people of color and victims of domestic violence.
Yes.
Awesome. Thanks, Erlyn.
You're very welcome.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Up now, MTV News critic Ingu Kang and Vulture's Alex Jung chat with me about the new film Ghost in the Shell and where it stands as a remake and within the larger discussion happening within Hollywood right now about the whitewashing and sidelining of Asian characters in Hollywood. Thank you for joining me today, Alex. It's great to have you on.
Thank you. Yeah. I'm always happy to be here.
And hey, Ingu, you are all the way in the Bay Area. I'm sure it's lovely out there.
It is sunny California every day.
Great to hear. So I guess we should just start off by saying that Alex and I went to the screening of Ghost in the Shell last night, and we had a very interesting experience.
Right, before the movie even started.
Before the movie started. So we're in this packed movie theater. There's a bunch of people. It's like a mixture of both critics and, you know, just people who get a sneak peek, right, who aren't necessarily within the film industry or the media industry. And, you know, the publicist, I think he's a publicist. He's a white dude. I don't know. He tells everyone, hey, you know, make sure your cell phones are off, the standard fare. And then at a perfect moment in between, like him taking a breath, someone on my left, to the left of me in the theater, yells, "Whitewashing!"
Right.
And all of a sudden, the white dude stops and he's like, "Who said that?" And I was immediately brought back to high school when you're like at an assembly.
Yes.
And some people start acting up and then the teacher's like,
"The principal is mad."
Yes. He's like, "Who said that?" And no one said anything. And he's like, I don't remember what happened. Did he go to them afterwards?
No, he went to them immediately. So basically, okay, what happened was he's like, you know, you're about to watch Ghost in the Shell. I was very close to what was I was literally, because there's a press section in the middle.
Right.
And then the side sections were occupied by, you know, normal, regular.
The normals. I don't know what to call them. The lay people? I don't know. Anyway.
Regular audience goers, yes, right, who get to see the movie. And so, you know, there was a group of black kids, and one of them was the one who yelled out the whitewashing part. And I laughed because I was like, that is so correct. And then the PR guy was like, "Who said that?" And then ran over to them, mm-hmm, right after he like introduced the movie. And the movie hasn't started yet, mind you. Ran over to them and was like, "Who said that? Which one of you said that?" Right? And it's like interrogating them.
Yes. It
was wild. And then one guy stood up and he's like, you know, "I'll take the heat and leave if you want me to," right? Mm. And he was like, "No, you don't have to leave. You know, this is just what I saw. You don't have to leave, but I want to make sure that you don't say anything during the movie," or whatever, right? He like turns it into this like, "I want you to create a quiet movie going experience."
Oh yeah,
for
he was totally scolding him.
Oh yeah, yeah. Oh, it was like definitely chastising him.
Yeah.
Although I know that on Twitter it sounded like maybe he was actually kicked out.
No, I think he was still there.
Oh, okay. I saw him there.
I never saw him leave.
Right.
Verlin jumping in. Yeah, I saw on Twitter people were going back and forth about it.
Right.
And they said that somebody identified themselves as the person, and he said he was kicked out.
Really? Okay. I didn't see him leave.
I didn't actually see that happen.
Yeah, so I didn't either.
Real journalism here.
Well, yeah, whatever. I just saw him, like, I saw the white guy go away, and then he was still sitting
right,
there.
Right,
so
right.
Unless maybe he was, I don't know. Anyway, so many, the optics of that was not good because it was this white bro PR guy going up and scolding this black, he looked like he was maybe in his early 20s, this black man. And also, had he yelled like, "I love Scarlett Johansson," would he have run over and been like,
"No.
No, are you going to say that during the movie?" No, it was because he said whitewashing. And it's like, come on. So anyway, that was our experience. It definitely set the mood. It set the tone for the rest of the screening.
And that was just weird.
Yeah.
So we're going to talk about primarily Ghost in the Shell, but this movie touches on so many other things that are happening just in general in Hollywood with representation of Asians and Asian Americans on screen. And why don't we just jump right into it? I mean, where do we start? I think we should start maybe with the original first. Sure. Just a brief like recap of the original, like what happens there, and then get into the movie, which in many ways is very, very different. They take right. a huge like shift. And
they make it Hollywood.
They make it super Hollywood. Yeah. So the original is 1995 anime film, really beloved. I just watched it for the first time in preparation to see this movie. Alex and I were talking about it, and Ingu, you've seen it, right? The anime original?
I have not seen it.
Oh, you have it. Okay. Well, that's okay, because it might actually have been maybe a better experience to not have seen it.
It's a gloriously weird movie.
Yeah, I think. It is. I definitely think it's worth seeing, but you might have liked the movie less, I think, if you had seen it before seeing the new one.
Right, because then you realize that a lot of the cool shots that the movie had were just cribbed from the anime movie.
Exactly. Alex, would you mind like talking a little bit about the original, like briefly summarizing?
Sure. I mean, I don't know. I'm not an anime expert by any means.
No, but... neither. We should just preface. At least I'm not. Alex isn't.
Nope.
Ingu, are you an anime expert?
I am the opposite of an anime expert.
Okay, so listeners, bear with us. We are not anime experts, but we do have an appreciation for these things, and we will do our best to address it from a non-anime like fan perspective.
Right. The original Ghost in the Shell is a manga that was written in the 80s, started in the 80s, and then it was adapted for film, as you said, in the 90s. I think what I like about it is that it's very wonderfully opaque in so many ways.
Yeah.
There's this kind of like shadowy multinational corporation. There's this idea that that we're in a future that is has no nations or boundaries, and there are these cybernetic robots that are like part human, part cyborg, that are weapons of, you know, that are agents and weapons in a fight. And it's kind of actually sometimes unclear what the stakes are, I think.
Yeah.
Or what exactly is happening.
Right. Like, it dives into this world without explaining anything, which is the opposite of what the new version does.
Right, right. Whereas the Hollywood movie is like, here's exactly what's happening. And it's very, very literal, right? In terms of like, we put a person's brain into a robot's body, and that's the ghost in the shell. To me, what was interesting about it is it sort of raised philosophical issues about like what constituted an identity, what constituted personhood to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the Hollywood ones, or you know, this one seemed more interested in making it about a love story, and was more just about like memories.
Right.
Which to me seemed a little more basic.
Yes. It feels like the story we've seen many, many times in sci-fi at this point. So the Major is the main character in both of these movies. And this time we have Scarlett Johansson playing the Major.
Right.
Let's just get into the new version now. For listeners, there's major spoilers towards the end, the last act of the film, that we learn about the Major and also other characters. And so for this first part, we're going to do a little non-spoilery, and most of it will be stuff that's like not that surprising. And then we'll warn you before we get to the very spoilery stuff if you have not seen it or if you prefer not to know what's going to happen. So we'll warn you before we get to that part. But to start off with, the Major... She starts off not as the Major. She starts off as a, you know, I guess a brain that has been implanted into a completely cyborg body. Like, it's not the only part of her that is human is the brain. And she's the first of her kind. I don't remember that being an aspect of the anime film.
No, it's not.
Yeah. And so Juliette Binoche's character, who is a scientist, she's hoping that this could be like the start of a very new project. But you also have the bad guy, Cutter, who's played by the actor Peter Ferdinando. And he's, you know, the big corporate honcho who wants to use her as a weapon. And they never really explain like how. It's just like he's evil weapons. Like, that's what he wants. And it's all about Scarlett, or all about the major trying to, you know, take down someone named Kuze, who's played by Michael Pitt. And that's basically, I guess, the main gist of it. We don't, like, we'll get into the other parts. But can I just have, like, your guys' thoughts on just setting aside all the controversy about Scarlett Johansson being cast and whitewashing. What are your thoughts? I'll start with you, Ingu.
I kept wondering, why did they remake Blade Runner when Blade Runner already exists and is a much more emotionally compelling movie besides, you know, like every single plot line is telegraphed 30 minutes beforehand. Mm-hmm. And so like the first, I don't know, like 30, 40 minutes of the movie is like hugely confusing because the world building is essentially, here's a building block, here's a building block, here's a building block. Just remember all of these building blocks. And then every point, like from that point forward, every stop in the storyline is, you know what's going to happen like 20 minutes before. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of it just felt like waiting it out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was beautiful, but, you know, I was basically just relieved I had something to look at while waiting for the plot to happen.
Right.
Yeah.
Production design is good.
The production design is great. The costumes were amazing. Like, I want Scarlett Johansson's bodysuit. It's pretty awesome. What about you, Alex? What were your thoughts? Also, Blade Runner is already being remade. So, right. Like, it's like we're going to have, like, two Blade Runners in a span of, like, a year or two because the new one's coming out soon, I think. With Ryan Reynolds. Or not Ryan Gosling.
And Harrison Ford.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's hard for me to... It's hard to appreciate the movie beyond, I think, pure just production value and design. Mm. Even the... And the thing is, it feels like a mashup of a lot of other things when you're watching it. It's definitely Blade Runner. It also reminded me just of the Bourne Identity.
Yeah.
Where I was just like, oh, they're just really going with that as like the main crux of the identity story.
Can I sort of jump in
and
say that because the plot was so boring, I kept thinking about every other thing that this reminded me of. And so like that is basically what kept me busy throughout the movie. So not only Blade Runner, which is sort of like the most obvious reference point, but also Westworld.
Oh, yeah.
And oh, yeah.
Also,
yeah.
Kind of lost in translation because who would have guessed that Scarlett Johansson would be like the standard bearer for like Tokyo as dystopia.
Right.
You know, it was just sort of like, I guess I will sit here and like, because this movie is so derivative, think about like every single thing it's derivative of.
Right. They were in Tokyo, right? Or like in Japan.
So here's the thing. In my, this is where my limited knowledge of anime comes in. But when I was reading up on the animated version of Ghost in the Shell, the director, Mamoru Oshii, Oshii. He, for the original film, he reportedly based the city on Hong Kong, actually.
Oh, okay.
So that it had Chinese influences, but I think in both versions it's supposed to be this rant, like it's not a distinct place, but that clearly looks kind of like an Asian world,
right.
Futuristic
right.
world.
Which speaks to the movie's sensibility, which is like, to me, you know, like it, what it does is it wants to have, like it wants to have the non-specificity of being, for instance, in Tokyo, but it wants to have all of the accoutrement of like Orientalism, basically,
right.
surrounding it. So they have like geishas, they have, you know, like giant signs written in Japanese. Mm-hmm. They have the kind of like congestion that you associate with cities like Hong Kong or Tokyo or Seoul. And, you know, like they sort of like want to take all of the things that people associate with Asia or specifically in some ways Japan without actually being specific about the narrative in any way.
Right. The other thing that struck me is how just like Scarlett Johansson, notwithstanding, like
the cast around her and the people within the city are very, very international. You've got, you know, Brits, you have Black Brits, you have like African, like one African, I don't know, ambassador or something who's supposed to stand in for leader of Africa or something.
They decided to make one, pick one.
Right. And so he stood in for all of Africa. And then you also have like some, you know, people who you can't really tell what they are, but they're clearly people of color. You have lots of different Asian actors. So it was this weird like hodgepodge of people. So it felt like New York, but in like Tokyo or Hong Kong.
Actually, I would push back against that a little bit because mm-hmm. I don't think it even felt like New York. It felt like every single Hollywood dystopia, especially sort of like every single Hollywood YA dystopia, which is basically predicated on everything being awful, but there's no racism anymore. And so you have this kind of racial utopia, except it's always centered still on a white protagonist. Mm-hmm.
Right. I by New York, I meant in terms of just diversity. Just in terms of it being like there, it's very international, lots of different ethnicities there. But yes, I agree with you on that. The fact that it's clearly like every other dystopia you've ever seen in every movie.
And something that like also really struck me is that, you know, so much of this movie is about how you have sort of a meat sack and then like your soul, right? And it's amazing to what extent that this movie has done that to Japanese culture, which is to sort of like wear the costume of Japanese culture. And then to sort of get rid of every single like weird tension essentially within Japanese culture itself about race and ethnicity, and to essentially like supplant American neuroses and American conversations about race onto this fake Tokyo.
Right. I mean, I guess that's a good occasion to sort of dive into the controversy around this movie, because even before Scarlett Johansson was cast, actually, I think at one point there was another white actress who was being talked about for the role. I think it was Margot Robbie. I was going to say Margot Channing.
Margot Martindale, which case, I would have been okay with that.
But Margot Robbie, I think there were talks of her being in the film before Scarlett Johansson. And then when she got cast, obviously people were like, what? Why? and she has not, like many people, white actors recently, she has not done herself any favors in responding to it in public. Earlier this week, she was on Good Morning America and she was asked about it. And she basically said, she called it her character, quote unquote, identity-less, which is why it was okay for her to be cast. And she says, I think this character is living a very unique experience that in that she has a human brain and an entirely machinate body. I think that's how you pronounce it. I would never attempt to play a person of a different race, obviously. Hopefully any question that comes up of my casting will be answered by audiences when they see the film. So there are a couple of things going on with that. Mm-hmm. The idea that she is identityless, in some ways, to me, it kind of goes with this notion that whiteness is like a blank slate that you can project anything onto. Like it's everything and nothing at the same time. And which gives white people carte blanche to just like play all these different roles that they, you know, maybe shouldn't be playing.
Right.
And it also says to me, she's kind of using the same argument that people of color use, and anyone who feels, you know, they aren't represented on screen, when we talk about characters who ostensibly could be played by anyone, we say, well, this is a fictional character, like, why can't it be played by a person of color? And she's saying, this person has no identity, so why can't she be played by a white person? Except for the fact that that's always the default, it seems. I don't want to get into the spoilers yet. But, I mean, do you guys think that it was okay that she was cast in this role after having seen the film?
No.
Ingu?
Yes.
Yes, you think
it's okay? Sorry.
Wait, do you?
I feel like a race traitor a little bit saying
Ooh. That. No. This makes this interesting. Yeah. Wait, okay. So why do you think it's okay? Or why are you okay with it?
Well, for me, this is not like a super clear-cut case of whitewashing in the sense that, for example, Emma Stone's character in Aloha was. I think that there is definitely, you know, like I'm perfectly aware of the decades-long tradition in Hollywood of white actors taking over Asian roles. But I also sort of think that the story is so general. Like we've already talked about all of the other movies and TV shows that this show resembles. And so for me, because it's such a non-specific story, it makes sense on a certain level for Scarlett Johansson to play this particular role if we're looking at this movie, I guess, sort of like in a cultural vacuum. I think that there are certain things that they should not have done. For example, they did not need to give Scarlett Johansson, who was known for her blonde hair and blue eyes, black hair and black eyes, in order for her to look, quote unquote, like more Asian. I had a lot more issues with like gender and sort of like racialized gender than just race itself, if that makes sense.
Mm.
I mean, there are a lot of, you know, like Hollywood adapts Asian films all the time. And then they make them in with white characters, sort of just taking from the original source material. That's, you know, that's common practice. I don't necessarily have a problem with that. And I think that initially, if the film had sort of simply done that, I would have been more okay with it than if I felt than what the actual plot does.
Well, okay, we can't skate around this anymore. I think we should just get into spoilers. So, if you're listening and you don't want to know, this film diverges pretty strongly from the original film. And so, if you've seen the original, this will still be a spoiler if you're not aware. So let's just get into that. So
Scarlett's you know, her body, she thinks she's one person and she says her name is Major something. I don't remember. Caitlin or something like that.
Yeah.
It's like Mary Killian or something.
Right,
like that.
Right. It's something like incredibly white.
Yes.
And like vaguely Irish sounding at that. And then she realizes, like, once she stops taking the drugs that suppress her, like, memories, she realizes that she was actually a Japanese runaway named Motoko Kusanagi, who, not incidentally, is the name of the original
right.
Major from the manga and the anime. So I think this is where it, like, actually, to me, was the problem in some ways. Because I don't actually have a problem even with the idea of, like, what would it be like if a Japanese person had been implanted into a white cyborg's body, right? Like, that's, like, kind of an interesting question, but that's not a question that, like, that's not a question of identity or gendered identity or racialized gender either of what the movie was interested in doing. It just sort of accepted this as fact in some ways and accepted that in this world, this is something that completely makes sense. And I assume that's sort of where Scarlett is coming from in terms of saying that, you know, she thinks of this as identityless. But the problem, you know, with the world building in part is that you don't really have a sense of it. It just relies on these really cheap, superficial elements of, like, you know, this is like a mishmash of like different cultures and worlds and Africa and Asia, right? Like
yeah.
coming together with white protagonists, right? Like that's sort of the world that you've created in which that seems to be enough of an excuse to then like have her basically be a Japanese runaway who does not speak Japanese.
Yeah.
And her Japanese mom, who she meets later, only speaks to her in English.
Right. So that also was weird to me because so her boss at the her boss, who we mentioned earlier, the chief, Aramaki is his character name. He speaks in Japanese throughout the entire film, and she speaks in English. So, like, you know, she understands Japanese, but she doesn't speak it,
right?
Which is fine.
Right.
But then when she suddenly realizes, when she learns that she had this other identity and goes to find her, like, she finds this thing that has an apartment number on it. So she goes to the apartment, and this woman, who's an Asian woman, comes out, and she's like, "Oh, you found my cat. Come on inside." Like, never met her. Like, and this woman speaks in English.
Right.
Like, which I thought was weird. Like, it was a weird continuity thing. And it turns out, obviously, she's her mother.
Right.
And I mean, for me, the way my problem with that, the way this, it turns out she was an Asian woman in her other life, Scarlett Johansson, is that it felt like I could see the wheels turning in some writer or executive's head, where it's like, we know we're going to be accused of whitewashing. Like, this is happening right now. So maybe we can make this a little bit better by, you know, having her actually have been a Japanese woman. But so that she's somehow representing a Japanese character, like the Japanese woman is still exists within the story. It's just that now Scarlett Johansson, who is way more of a bankable star than any Japanese Japanese actress or Asian actress we can think of, will play the lead character. And well, yeah,
can we back up a little bit though? Because like one thing that I almost liked in this movie is the fact that she has these two moms, essentially, right? She has her real mom, who gave birth to, I guess, like, the person that, like, whose brain she's from, the Motoko. And then she has, and then Major, Scarlett Johansson's character, also has a kind of, like, Dr. Frankenstein mom, right, played by Juliette Binoche.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, again, I thought it was also interesting that, like, when we find out about the lover, he's also a Japanese man named Hideo, who is put into a white person's body.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel like if I were in a generous mood, I would say, well, I mean, like, of course, these white scientists are going to use white, they're going to have, like, white babies, quote unquote. And so, like, for them, it doesn't matter that they are putting these Japanese people into white bodies.
Yeah.
Like, you could sort of almost look at that kind of default whiteness as part of the villainy in the movie.
It's reverse Get Out.
Yes, reverse Get Out. but yeah, that's actually a good point.
No, I think that is interesting. But I think that there's no real savvy or it's just there's no understanding to me that this is a world or identity or something that is interesting to sort of explore.
Right,
it's just kind of done and accepted, or the audience is expected to just accept that as the default. And I think that's sort of where the problem comes in for me.
Exactly.
And I think that goes back to your point, Ingu, earlier about the fact that this movie doesn't deal in any way with race. Like, even though there are all these different ethnicities and people, like, in this world, it's as if racism doesn't exist. And so to have something so stark that, like, harkens back to all of these examples of, like, the body being experimented on for people of color, especially by the United States, for medical purposes and for technological purposes, and having all of that history and not even trying to engage with it a little bit and just saying this is what it is. I mean, granted, I don't know if I would trust a big Hollywood movie to do that, but the fact that they didn't even seem to try was, like, my big issue with it.
Yeah, I mean, if, for example, if this movie were a pilot and then the rest of the season sort of talked about, like, I mean, so much of this movie is sort of predicated on this question of belonging and family and community, because the Scarlett Johansson doesn't have any of that. And so for me, especially with all of these, like, parallel mother-daughter relationships, the first question for me would be, what is it like to finally find your mother, but also realize that you no longer look anything like your mother because of the thing that's been done to you? And so if the movie had a whole season to develop this idea about, like, what is my identity now that it's been put into this, like, utterly foreign thing. Like, that would have been actually interesting. And I feel like maybe that's where sort of part of my forgiveness toward the movie comes in, because I feel like there's potential. It's just that the execution is, like, piss poor.
Right. And then I am sympathetic to that. It is something that I think about. But, you know, as we sort of talked about before, you know, we don't exist in a cultural vacuum either. And so the fact that, like, the sort of identity switch also needs to happen in this way speaks to me more about, you know, it speaks more about capital and production and how we sort of view who is marketable and bankable than it is about the narrative itself.
I really want to go back to that, too. I'm sorry for interrupting.
No, you should.
You should, yes.
I'm going to talk over a man this time.
Yes, feminism.
I mean, like, the movie is so special effects driven. I do not understand why they couldn't have an Asian star. Like, I understand that Scarlett Johansson is a big name.
Right.
But we currently live right now in a film landscape that is dominated by, you know, name recognition and intellectual property. Like, the conversation about how there's no such thing as a bankable movie star. Like, this is an old industry narrative by now. Like, the chief reason to watch this movie is the special effects. And it's not like Scarlett Johansson, who is a great actress, it's not like she brings in any human chemistry. She doesn't bring in any sort of, like, warmth or humanity the way that she even did in the movie Her, when it was only her voice.
Right.
It almost sort of reminded me of that Underworld, which is, like, about vampires.
Oh, with Kate Beckinsale?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Like, who, I mean, like, sorry, but, like, who cares about Kate Beckinsale? Like, it could have been almost, like, literally anyone in that role. And that movie would have done gangbusters. And that's how I feel about this movie. Like, you don't need Scarlett Johansson.
Right.
No, you don't. I mean, that's the thing, right? Also, it's not like Ghost in the Shell isn't an unknown property. So I feel like it on its own, like, you could have cast anyone in this role and people would still go see it. I mean, isn't the answer, though, like, or at least the answer that Hollywood always gives is like, it's China. It's like, we want an international audience. And if we don't have a star there, who is almost always white, with the exception of, like, maybe Will Smith at this point, like, if we don't have a star there, it's not going to sell overseas. Now, that's not a true statement whatsoever, right, but that is the narrative they are always, that's what they fall back on every time.
I'm also, I mean, just in general, this is my own gripe. I think I'm really tired of the profit motive being the acceptable explanation that everyone is sort of like, okay, that makes sense. You should make as much money as possible.
But that's the thing,
right? Regardless of anything else.
Well, we live in America and capitalism is like what we, like, you can't, what's that line? It's like by Jay-Z, it's like, men lie, women lie, numbers don't. It's like, we only care about numbers. Numbers are the end goal and you can't deny numbers. So that's what they fall back on. I agree with you that it should not be that way.
Right.
But
I'm just getting very tired of it. Especially, and then it also makes me a little worried in some ways when, like, movies like Get Out and Hidden Figures do so well, and the argument for why, the argument becomes a one around capital too, which makes me uncomfortable. Because I don't think the profit motive should be the sole reason why you make things, right? Why you make, you know, films with people of color in them as the stars. Like, that's a bad reason to me to make a movie. And so, anyway, sorry. I just had to throw that gripe in there.
Very true thoughts. I mean, if we wanted to fold in, we have, so this is not obviously the only movie or TV show right now that people are accusing of whitewashing. We also have, you know, Iron Fist, which came out last week on Netflix. And the controversy around that is the fact that it's the newest Marvel TV show to enter into the TV world. And the lead character, Danny Rand, is played by a white actor named
Finn Jones.
And he also has not done himself any favors with some of the comments he's made.
Yes.
But here's the thing is that, like, it's not quite the same. So it's not quite the same It's not doing the same things that Ghost in the Shell is. Like, it's not really whitewashing technically because the original comic book character right. was also white.
Right.
The issue is that people just saw an opportunity and, you know, the writers decided not to take it.
Right.
And I mean, why, like, that also couldn't be
I don't think, I haven't seen Iron Fist, but it doesn't seem to be completely innocent.
It's so bad, Ingo. It's so bad.
Don't watch it. I watched the first two episodes and I was bored out of my mind.
It's so bad.
Yeah,
it's
just don't.
It's still essentially about like a white guy who goes to Asia to learn ninja and then ends up being like the best ninja, right?
Yep.
Like,
yep. Oh no, you've seen it before, even though you haven't seen it.
That's how I feel about everything Marvel.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I mean, but what was the argument for doing that? Like, because you interviewed the actor Louis Tan, who was apparently sort of, I don't know, the runner-up, or he was like...
That's what it felt like, right?
Yeah, he was one of the... He was close to having the role right. that Finn Jones plays.
Right.
And that was that your conversation with him on Vulture was very fascinating.
Yeah.
Especially, one reason not to watch Iron Fist is that the fight scenes are pretty terrible.
Oh, they're awful.
Like...
They're
terribly choreographed. Yeah. And when your entire show rests on like kung fu and fighting, I expect it and it's a Marvel show. I expect it to be very good.
Right.
It is not. But Louis Tan is actually a martial artist.
Yeah. And so is his dad.
Yeah.
There was a tweet that was going around that was of like a fight scene from Iron Fist. One scene that featured 40 cuts. And it's just like a great encapsulation of like how badly made this movie or this TV show was. And the fact that, you know, they hired someone who couldn't fight, right? He couldn't do the stunts in any way necessary, in a convincing way necessary. And so they had to do a lot of camera tricks around him.
Yeah.
Like you just see a fist, right?
Yes.
An iron fist. like popping in and out of the frame. But yeah, no. So I talked to Louis Tan, who plays, he appears in episode 8 as, he's like, he does drunken kung fu. And he is, you know, essentially a one-off villain that Danny Rand has to go through in the plot. And so he's only in it for like, I don't know, 5-6 minutes or so. It's a pretty short scene. And they have a fight scene. And it's arguably the best fight scene because he moves beautifully. And he sort of thinks about martial arts in a way that I think is really interesting, too, because I think he thinks of it in the tradition of someone like Bruce Lee and Jackie Chan, where it's a way to move your body and a way to express certain ideas through a different art form, right? And he's, you know, it helps that he's like a thirst trap. Like, he is hot.
He's very hot.
He's really hot. He's half Chinese. His father, Philip, was, like, grew up as an orphan in China, like, learned kung fu and martial arts, became a stunt coordinator in Hollywood, worked on Batman, you know, things like that.
Okay, so see, he has all the qualifications, it seems, to play this role. And he's a good actor. And yet, somehow, Finn Jones got it. And so...
Somehow.
So, again, so we
have... Twice as good to get half as much.
So, with all of these different projects, the issues that we're talking about keep changing, and I think that's something that we have to keep in mind. With Aloha, for example, it's literally about, like, a white actress playing a half-Asian, half-Hawaiian person. With Ghost in the Shell, it's about the American appropriation or reappropriation of a Japanese property. With Iron Fist, it's a very different thing, with the rehashing of a really old, really racist trope. And I think it's important to keep in mind when we're talking about all of these issues that it's not just one issue that we have to contend with. It's all of these like weird little variations that we have to think about, like, how much does this matter when we're looking at a project?
Yeah, there are a variety of ways Asian Americans get screwed over in Hollywood.
Yeah. No shortage. No shortage of ways. So now we'll move into our plus or delta segment. I think after sort of checking in with both of you, it seems like
this movie is our Delta for this week. I think we can all say that.
Sure. I'm okay with that.
Works for me.
Awesome. So that's our Delta. So let's go to happier things and go with our pluses. Ingu, would you like to go first?
Sure. Last week, I don't know how many people really out there watch a NBC sitcom called Superstore.
I love it.
Okay, good. Yay, one person. One other person.
I haven't caught up with it yet, but I will.
It's essentially a show that takes place in a sort of Walmart-like store and looks... It's sort of like if The Office took place in a Walmart. But it's a little bit more diverse than The Office. And there's a character that I had really liked from the beginning named Mateo.
Who, I love Mateo.
Played by Nico Santos, who we learn in season one is an undocumented worker. And so he uses a fake social security card. And the reason why I've always liked this character is that he is not just an undocumented worker who gets sort of like a very special episode, but he's kind of this like petty, mean guy who, you know, basically argues that undocumented workers are not always angels. Sometimes they're like that really like passive aggressive coworker that you can't stand to be around. They're just people. Mm-hmm. And so one thing that Superstore did last week was have an episode about him revisiting his immigration status, which I thought, you know, in the Trump era was sort of much more relevant. And his character, in addition to being undocumented, is gay and has a relationship with sort of like the district manager of the fake store in the show. And essentially, because of that relationship, he had to transfer out of that manager's area. And because he can't tell his boss slash boyfriend that he's undocumented, he sort of has to try to figure out, like, how do I negotiate my situation where I can keep my relationship and keep my job. And it was probably like the most layered, three-dimensional depiction of being an undocumented worker that I have seen. Mm-hmm. And so I really want to give a shout out to that episode.
Awesome. That's a great, great plus.
It is great. Mm-hmm. Especially because I love that show and I love Mateo so much. my plus is just something small that is maybe has a specific place in my heart. But I was talking to Joe Morton, who plays Eli Pope.
Yeah, I love him.
I love him.
Ah. So you're not going to just say that you were talking to him as if like it's not a big deal.
We were texting.
Just chilling.
I was interviewing Joe Morton, who plays Eli Pope on Scandal, for Vulture, because he had a big episode. And one of the things that I wanted to just talk to him about was Brother from Another Planet.
Yes, such a good movie.
Such a good movie.
Everyone should check it out.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's a John Sayles film from the 80s, Afrofuturist. He plays a mute character. Mm-hmm. And it's brilliant.
Yeah.
He's just brilliant in it. And the interview is great. I love Joe Morton. I think he's really honest about his experiences in Hollywood. And he's gotten a lot of really raw deals. Anyway, one of the things that he did mention, though, when I brought up Brother from Another Planet, is that it's being developed for television by John Sayles.
Ah.
And that John Sayles wants him to be in it in some fashion. And, you know, it's a great movie, especially to think about right now, and what you're talking about with undocumented immigrants too, because in a lot of ways you watch it now and you'll think about ICE officials trying to catch immigrants, you know, like it sort of calls to mind a lot of what's happening right now in this regime.
Yeah.
And to have Joe Morton in a role like that, I think would be so fun. And I, you know, I like the idea of sci-fi exploring the possibilities around race and belonging and immigration and all of these things that can happen but are often not explored.
Yeah, like in Ghost in the Shell.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was just like a little plus. It's like a little plus of a possible TV development that I think is
fun. I love that little plus. That's a great little plus. My plus is also little as well. Or, you know, it's not a huge thing. But I'm very excited that Grace and Frankie season 3 has dropped.
I love this show.
Wait, I didn't know this about you.
I love Grace and Frankie. It is at season 3. It's on Netflix. It stars Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin, who I adore both of them. Uh-huh. And I just love... I have been accused of, and rightfully accused sometimes, of being ageist in my state, like offhanded statements or whatever, because I'm a millennial, and you know, I feel like every generation they feel some sort of way towards older people. But what I love about the show is that it centers old people's experiences in a way, like it's sort of like the Golden Girls, but like way more modern. Like they talk about sex very frankly in a way that the Golden Girls did way back when, especially because Lily Tomlin's character, Frankie, is like, she's sort of like this hippie woman who is trying to get her vibrator company off the ground. Mm-hmm. She's trying to sell vibrators specifically for older people. Mm. And so in the first episode, I've only gotten so far into the first episode of the new season, but in the first episode, her and Grace are trying to get a loan together to get this product off the ground. And they go in to ask for a loan. And they're like, can we get a loan like 10 years to pay it back? And slowly it dawns on them. The guy's like, no, not 10 years. They're like, 7? They're like, no. And it's like, he thinks we're going to die in like a year.
Right.
So those little things. And it's a delightful show. It's a great cast. The basic premise of the show is that Grace and Frankie, their husbands were like prominent lawyers, and they've been married for years. And then their husbands admit that they are in love with each other and have been. And so they leave them for each other. Mm-hmm. And then Grace and Frankie, who never really like liked each other too much because they were very opposite people, they forge a friendship. Mm-hmm. Out of their grief. And it's just a great cast. Them, Martin Sheen, Sam Waterston as their husband or ex-husbands. I love Grace and Frankie. And I'm glad it's back. It's making me happy.
But why do you need a different kind of vibrator if you're an older person?
So they get, their hands get, arthritis. Seriously. you get more arthritis that way.
You need an ergonomically friendly.
Exactly. And with that, it was such a pleasure having Alex and Ingu on. Ingu, I'd love to have you back on. It was great chatting with you.
I would love to be back.
Yeah. And check her work out on MTV News and Alex's work on Vulture. And thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that is all. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much for listening to us. I really enjoyed recording this episode. It was great to have Verilyn on to recognize Big Little Lies earlier. It's always a pleasure to have my producer pop in from time to time. I hope y'all enjoy hearing her voice as much as I do. And it was also awesome to have Ingu and Alex come on to discuss Asian representation and Ghost in the Shell. You should come to our Facebook page, which is being managed by the wonderful Marissa Martinelli at Slate. She is great. She is awesome. She has been putting up all those wonderful links. So you should come and talk to us. Let us know what you think about the show. And of course, if you are not already doing so, you should subscribe to us on iTunes, Megaphone, Stitcher, or any other place you find your podcasts. And continue to rate us if you have not already. But please only rate us if you really, really like us. If you don't, just, don't tell us. You don't have to. Represent is produced by the lovely and amazing Verilyn Williams. The executive producer of Slate Podcast is Steve Lichtai. Andy Byers is chief content officer of Panoply. And you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Slate Represent. The music you're hearing right now is performed by the sweet San Francisco funk soul band Midtown Social, who are also dropping their first album in a few weeks. And we'll put a link to their website on our show page. Until next time. Thank you.